So thanks everybody for coming. It's really, really great. I'm really looking forward to learning about a lot of the recent work from the various communities here. My thought was to survey the history of QPV a little bit from a personal perspective and try, because I know we're bringing together people with different backgrounds, try to give just a little bit of an overview that introduces some of the work that later talks are going to discuss. But I also want to highlight what I think are important points about the different security models that we need to consider in QPV and give at least some toy back of the envelope calculations about the practical challenges for QPV. And then we're focusing here on QPV, but one of the big topics, as I guess you all know, is to what extent you could spoof quantum information processing in a prover by non-local computation. And I want to enlarge on that. I want to broaden that discussion out a little bit by highlighting other areas of cryptography where those questions are equally important. So there's even more motivation than people might have thought for all the intriguing work on the efficiency or otherwise of non-local computations emulating local computations. The first part of the talk is joint work with Damien, who is here. Okay. Did you just come in or did I miss? Yeah, okay. Damien, who has arrived precisely on time, excellent. And George, and I'd like to thank them both for our collaboration. Let's see if I can. Okay, so the idea of QPV goes back, I guess, to work in 2002 that ended up as a joint patent. And the idea, as I guess is now familiar to everyone, is that you use both the properties of quantum information and the light speed signaling bound to try to devise schemes that are hard or ideally impossible to spoof by sending in 1D signals from two verifiers to what we called a tag. So the tag, aka prover, and I'll say more about the terminology in a minute, sits in the middle here. It receives classical and quantum information, it returns it, and ideally everything is happening at light speed. And this idea made it into the academic literature in a couple of papers in 2010, one by Mullaney and another one by Chandran and colleagues. And there's an intuition underlying all this, which Chandran and colleagues in particular tried to make into a proof, that if you synchronize everything and if you use quantum and classical signals so they arrive together, so one example would be you send a quantum state in here and you send classical instructions to measure that state or perhaps to reroute the state. The intuition, which turns out to be wrong, of course, is that you can't copy the quantum information, and so anybody who's tried to spoof this doesn't really have any option except to let it propagate here. And if you let it propagate to the tag, it's too late to do any useful spoofing. And the light speed signaling bounds take care of the rest of this. And so the scheme ought to be secure if you devise the scheme right. But we already knew that intuition, unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, because it leads to lots of interesting stuff, that intuition is wrong. There's a sneaky attack that involves local quantum operations and pre-shared entanglement, which can be applied by spoofers in this example, here and here. And for simple schemes, just needs a teleportation operation and local quantum operations and classical communication, which allows the spoofers to perfectly emulate the behavior that was expected from the tag, return the signals as in the form expected to the verifiers, and defeat, at least in principle, the security of the scheme. So I'm not going to say so much about this, partly because I know Harry is up next. But just to underline, all the schemes proposed, including Chandran et al.'s, are in principle insecure. Spoofers can use teleportation to simulate the operations of the tag, even though the quantum information never actually gets to the tag. So those attacks that we pointed out applied to all the published tagging protocols, and including some that we put in the paper, but not to the most general possible protocol. They, I guess, inspired a much more powerful and beautiful general no-go theorem by Harry and colleagues, also in 2010, that applies to every QPV or tagging scheme in the security model I've been talking about so far. Again, Harry is going to speak next, so I will leave the details to him, but I want to just highlight the importance of that work. It really sort of transformed everybody's perspective on the field. So one of our aims here, I guess, one of our collective aims, is to try to understand what we can base security of QPV on. And to do that, we need to be clear what we're actually trying to achieve. So we're trying to verify the position of, well, of what? Of something. What exactly is it we're trying to verify the position of? Are we trying to verify the position of a tagging device? Something like this. Or are we trying to verify the position of a person or a thing that the tag is attached to? So I would argue the answer is absolutely clear. It has to be the second of those. There's no sense in making a whole set of devices that are locatable, even if we can make them securely locatable, just in order to be able to say, well, now we've got these things that we can locate. They're not valuable in themselves. The aim of this technology has to be to keep track of people or things because we value them, or perhaps because we fear them and want to be sure they're in the right place. You could think of a prisoner being tagged, for example, or some hazardous waste that you want to be sure stays where it's supposed to be. So we have to think of the device as carried by or attached to, or perhaps even, although with people that's a little spooky, but perhaps even embedded within the thing that it's tagging. And that means there's a security worry that hasn't been considered a great deal, but we need to worry about separation attacks. We need to consider the possibility that the tag and the taggee could become detached like that. And if that happens, if, say, spoofers are able either physically to detach it or to, by some sort of sleight of hand, to persuade the person to wander away and leave maybe a mobile phone that they're carrying in the right place, your tagging scheme is none the wiser. Of course, it's still responding. But you're no longer verifying the position of what you actually wanted to verify. And of course, we can think of this as spoofers, but there are situations where you're very worried about the motives of the person themselves. If they're a criminal with a tag, they've got every incentive to try and detach their own tag if they can, maybe with a collaboration of friends, and leave the tag in place and roam free. So there's actually another annoying but relevant security issue that's related to this. So most of the literature, including our models, Chandran et al., Boorman et al., and most subsequent literature, assume that we have a tagging device that follows a public algorithm. And you think about that's sort of necessary for most of these discussions, because the spoofing attacks rely on non-locally simulating local operations, and you can't do that unless you know what it is it's simulating. But if the algorithm's public, then the device can be replicated. The device can be replicated by the spoofers. So they can make another copy here, and potentially, at least, they can apply let's call it a dislocation replacement attack. They can persuade, without detaching the tag, they can persuade or cajole or force the taggee and tag to displace and replace them by a copy. And if that happens, let's say in the interval between queries, and then again, you're none the wiser. This is an identical copy of the tag. It will respond just as the original did. But the security has been broken. So let's be clear. In the original security model, at least, QPV protocols might guarantee that a device is at the right location, but they don't necessarily guarantee that the original device, the one you thought you cared about, is at the right location. And of course, as I've already highlighted, even the guarantee that a device is at the given location, as far as we understand it in the moment in that model, can only be given based on technological bounds on what the spoofers can do, maybe on how much entanglement they control. So a QPV protocol, to sum up, it ought to aim to verify the position of a tagged person or object. It needs some defense against separation attacks. It needs some defense against dislocation replacement attacks. And I want to highlight some worries that I hope, some ambiguities that I hope we can sort of get past in the terminology. The term prover is potentially misleading here if you're not careful. It's perfectly fine in the context in which there's a precisely spelled out mathematical model, and there either is a prover there or there is not a prover there, and the question is whether in the absence of the prover at the location, spoofers can, who are elsewhere, can simulate the prover. And in those models, it applies to a particular device. But the name sort of suggests that something more extended. It suggests an agent carrying the device. And we need to be clear about which we're talking about. And we shouldn't sort of take the mathematical analysis that just applies to a particular device and unconsciously carry over the conclusions to say we've got a scheme that's securely verifies the location of the taggee carrying a specific device rather than a copy of the device. And the term tag also is maybe potentially misleading. It tends to suggest something that's easily detached, or it can do, at least in some contexts. But as I said, it could be a very integral part of the taggee. It could be an integral part of a satellite or a plane. In principle, still separable, but maybe with great difficulty. Okay, so alas, I think it's pretty clear there are no unconditionally secure defenses against either of these two attacks. Security has to be based on physical assumptions when it comes to considering these. So we would want the tag to be hard to detach. I probably want it to be hard for somebody to move the tag and or the taggee very fast. You might think about extending your protocol so that there's some sort of alarm in which detaching or moving the tag sets off an alarm, and that's hard for the adversaries to prevent. But all of those are physical mechanisms based on physical assumptions. So given those, you might want to think about another physical assumption. Maybe the tag itself is hard to replicate. That would at least defend against replacement attacks. But we can't assume that in the original security model. Already agreed that. Its functionality is public. On the other hand, given that we need physical assumptions anyway, I would argue that in many scenarios it's reasonable to add a further physical assumption, which is actually much more standard in quantum cryptography and classical cryptography than any of these three, namely that the tag can keep data secure. In other words, it can keep data that's been pre-shared between the verifiers and the tag, so it's known to the verifiers, but it's not known to the adversaries. And then we can effectively make it impossible to replicate, up to small probability of guessing. So the spoofers' problem here now is they They see there's a tag, they know there's a secure key. They might be able to replicate the outside of the tag, but they just don't know what to put in the key storage. To be pedantic about it, well, yes, they can produce a replica of the tag because they can make tags with all possible keys. So really their problem is making an identifiable replica. It's not very helpful to them to have 10 to the 9 tags, one of which has the right key, because they don't know which one to use in their spoofing attack. Okay, so we have already a couple of different security models that I would argue are both interesting. The original one, we can't assume the tag's hard to replicate, so I represent this as sort of porous boundaries. Nothing inside here is secret. And the second one in which the tag can keep data secure, so it's known to the verifiers, but not to adversaries, like so. And I'm going to try and persuade you that there's a third interesting model in which the tag has the additional property that it can keep a reliable clock that's previously synchronized with the verifiers' clocks. And given that, you might well say, well, you've now got two binary options. So there's a fourth possibility. Maybe it could contain a reliable clock previously synchronized, but it can't keep data secure. I don't think that turns out to be very useful. I'll explain why in a minute. But the first three, I think, are. So let's forget about the clocks for a minute and focus on the second model, where the tag can keep data secure. So as I pointed out a while ago, secure QPV is relatively easy in this model. If the verifiers and the tag share a secure key, they can and they can communicate at light speed, then they can exchange queries and responses about that key. And you might worry that the key has only finite length. Well, it will only have finite length. But in principle, if the tag has a QKD receiver, we can indefinitely expand the key, even during the protocol, so that there's effectively an infinite supply of shared secret key. So to sort of spell this out a little bit more, give one concrete version of this, we can assume that each of the verifiers, let's call them AI, shares separately a key, a random secret key KI, which is broken up into substrings KI1 to KIN with the tag before the protocol. And those substrings themselves have a couple of parts, a query, QIJ, and a response, RIJ. And in round J of the protocol, so I'm going to focus on the simplest case in which there's a purported location L that the AIs know, and they're trying to verify that the tag is actually at that location L. We could talk also about the more complicated case in which the tag is somewhere around and the AIs are trying to work out where it is, but I want to keep things simple for now. In round J, then, they know how to send a signal at light speed that will arrive at that purported location at a given time. So in round J, they send their query. The ith verifier sends query I for round J to arrive at some specified time TJ at the presumed location. The tag verifies that QIJ corresponds to its record of QIJ, and if, and only if it does, responds with its response, RIJ. AI checks that RIJ is correct, and if they all verify, and they need to communicate with each other to check that, or at least they all need to communicate to one of them, then they accept the tag was within some uncertainty delta of the desired location at that time. So in 1D, it looks like this. The query and response from the two sides converge here. Sorry, the queries from the two sides converge here, and the responses go out, like so. Let me stress again, although there's a finite key shared before the protocol, if the tag's equipped for QKD, the keys can be replenished. And let me also stress the thing, this thing I've just mentioned. You're never going to verify precisely the location of attack. There are always going to be timing delays, there are always going to be uncertainties. So this parameter delta is always non-zero, and it's a crucial, obviously a crucial parameter. We want schemes that minimize it. So how, I mean, I'm really throwing things out for experimentalists to give better estimates, so to cut down. Yeah, but here are some back of the envelope estimates about what you might be able to achieve. I'm going to assume that all the comms are classical because that's the scheme we're talking about. I'm going to assume that there's no classical errors in the communications. It's not going to matter much if there's a small error rate anyway. I'm going to assume that the communications are direct, absolutely direct line, free space at precisely light speed. Obviously, that's a slight idealization, but it's the best case. We could take query and response substrings of about 30 bits. That gives a probability of successful spoofing on each round of about 10 to the minus 9. I'm going to assume that's good enough. Our estimate, we haven't done this, but our best estimate as far as we understand it is that if you use state-of-the-art FPGAs, so the tag's got to verify the query compared to its record, and we think or hope that can be done within about 10 nanoseconds, the verification and response. And that already, that's a short time, but light, of course, travels fast, so that already gives you a lower bound that's non-trivial, about 3 meters for the uncertainty in the location of the tag. If you assume the tag is a black box and you're just dealing with the data response, if you assume something more about its functionality and the delays are symmetric for the responses both sides, you should be able to do better than that. But I'm going to stick with the black box view here for the moment, just to get some idea of the numbers. Suppose you verify every microsecond. Then the tag can move no more than 300 meters between responses if it moves at light speed. Is that good or bad? I don't know. And for four verifiers, you'd be consuming, so four, 30 bits for the query, 30 for the responses, 60, and then 10 to the 6 times per second. So about 2 times 10 to the 8 key bits per second. So it's quite key intensive. You might think that worrying about the tag and or tag E moving at light speed is a little bit sort of fantastical. And maybe something like the speed of sound would be a better bound. That improves this figure a lot. It can now only move 3 × 10⁻⁴ meters between responses. We haven't changed at the moment the query response rate, so we still have the same key bit consumption. But you might then think, given those figures, you might be able to get away with a verification around every millisecond, and still the tag can move by less than a meter if it's bounded by the speed of sound. And that now only consumes about 2 × 10⁵ key bits per second, which is demanding, but looking rather more reasonable. I want to highlight, these are challenging numbers for the protocol I've just highlighted, but they're also challenging numbers for, I think, every QPV protocol, including those involving QIP in the standard security model. The measurement and response times are crucial. Even measurement response times of order of 10 nanoseconds give significant uncertainty in the position of the tag. And I'd like to understand how fast we can actually hope to measure and get the result of, say, a photon polarization measurement, or how fast we could hope to reroute a quantum signal. And we still have this issue about how fast the tag can move. Even if we have a round every microsecond, as long as we only use the light speed bound, there's still the potential to move up to 300 meters between bounds, and if you can shift one thing out at light speed and move another one in at light speed, He certainly got a lot of space in which to do that. Okay, so now I want to look at how things change and in fact improve if you assume the tag has a secure synchronized clock. The idea here now is that the tag's going to release its responses to authenticated queries, but not as the queries come in, but at times that have been agreed in advance. And they could either be agreed according to some fixed schedule, like every microsecond, or they could be agreed according to a random secret schedule that itself is communicated securely between the tag and the verifiers. What does that do? Well, it saves you the information processing delay because the tag can do all its verification well in advance, hours, days in advance if it wants to, and just get ready to release the appropriate responses at the precise time, let's say noon, that it's supposed to. It also replaces the time it actually takes to send a signal with the uncertainty in that time. So I would guess, and this is just a sort of hand-wavy guess, that it gives us an improvement on position uncertainty of at least one order of magnitude, maybe more, hopefully more. Obviously, you're demanding more of the tag. It's got to hold a synchronized clock, so it's more technologically demanding. Also, there are potential issues with clock desynchronization, which could happen naturally. You synchronize clocks, but they don't stay in sync forever, and especially if they're relatively miniaturized, that can be an issue. It could also happen as a result of adversarial actions. Maybe the spoofers can't penetrate the tag at all. If they can, then maybe they can mess up the clock a bit. But there's also this fantastical sounding, but I guess issue that's necessary to consider, that if the spoofers can move the tag, and they can move it fast, things comparable to light speed, they can cause the proper time on its clock to be significantly out of sync with the proper time of the verifiers who are in rest frame. That doesn't immediately seem advantageous because it's slowing the tag with respect to the verifiers, and the verifiers will notice that the responses are coming later than they should. But it's an issue that I think needs more careful thought. And then I mentioned this fourth possibility, no secure data, but a synchronized clock. Not clear to me, not clear to us at the moment that this is a useful model. If the tag can't keep data secure, then storing it in order to respond at later times is also insecure, because once it's stored, the verifiers can read it. And this also applies, alas, to storing quantum information that's been generated. So it's not clear to me there's a useful advantage in adding clocks in the standard security model. But there might be, because you could certainly imagine running an argument to say that I can realistically think that my stored quantum information can be kept secure through error correction or through its fragility. Maybe it can be measured but not stolen, even though my stored classical information can't. So on the face of it, not a very useful security model, but maybe actually in the quantum case there's value in considering it further. Okay, another interesting idea, which Harry and Florian and I thought about for a while, at least we found it interesting, is to think of a tag with internal structure. So you could think of, improve a verifier language. You could think of this as a some sort of network of provers who are in a relatively small region. And queries are coming in from the verifiers, but the protocol instructs the provers to exchange information about those queries amongst themselves and produce responses according to some predefined algorithm, but maybe a quite complicated algorithm that involves processing all the information, communicating at light speed, and sending stuff out. Does that give more security? Does that possibly give unconditional security? Just to step back for a minute, it feeds into a sort of general program that I think we've made some progress on, but it's still by and large incomplete. Trying to understand which quantum tasks in space-time are possible and which are provably impossible. So the idea here is that you have some network of agents, let's call them collectively Alice, but they're distributed, and it's important, they're distributed all over space-time, wherever she needs them to be. And they're all working together, and they know the nature of the task, and the task is going to take the form of the following. Inputs, these red arrows, are going to arrive at various points in space-time, and those inputs can be classical and or quantum, and I guess for it to be interesting, at least some of them should be quantum. And they're going to be required to produce outputs at some other set of points, which some of them could coincide, which depend on the inputs in a prescribed way, and maybe also depend on the input points that are used. So if a task is impossible, it implies some restriction on the flow of information, and that's at least potentially useful for cryptography. It means there's something your adversary might want to do that they can't do. If a task is possible, and especially if it's surprisingly possible, that's computationally useful. It means you could do quantum computations in space-time that look interesting, and you can do them more efficiently than you originally thought. But cryptographically threatening, as with the spoofing of QPV. And the nicest way to answer the multiple prover case, I think, and to see that it, even with many provers, it's still breakable, is another beautiful general result by Kfir, who's here, that generalizes Harry and Friends' no-go theorem in this paper. And they're really, Kfir may say more about this. I'll just try and give a tiny summary. The thought is to represent tasks as a space-time circuit so that you have inputs at these blue points, outputs at these red points, and gates of whatever form at these green points. If there is any circuit that implements the task, then by definition, the task is possible. And the first beautiful and a priori surprising result is the possibility depends only on the causal structure of the task, the coarse causal structure. It only depends on the causal relations between the input and the output points, not on anything, not any details about the separations or locations.
Sorry.
Yep.
So as long as they can't the angle can't be less than 45 degrees because that.
Right. If somebody's in the pass light cone and you move them outside the pass light cone, then it changes the condition. And the second beautiful result, if it's possible, it's possible with no gates at all. So in principle, you could throw away all these green dots and just use pre-distributed entanglement of communication between the input and output points. And we're going to hear a lot more about holography and ADS CFT. But this is already a version of the holographic principle, to my mind at least. What it's telling you is that every physical system is perfectly simulable by devices on some distant surface that surrounds it. You have a picture like this. Here's a crystal. You could fire whatever you like at it. In principle, you can model the crystal, however complicated it is, by some complex network of gates. And you can have cameras and other things looking at what's reflected and transmitted from the crystal. But it's all spoofable. Spoofing devices on the boundary could simulate the crystal's responses to any probes. So I think that's really lovely and intriguing. Okay, so I said I wanted to broaden the discussion out a little and look at other areas of quantum computation and quantum cryptography where the simulation of local computations by non-local computations, or the efficiency of non-local computations is important. Let me start with a task that goes by the name summoning. The basic idea here now is that we have two agencies. So again, I stress their agencies. Alice is not just one person at one place, but a whole collection of agents spread throughout space-time. And Bob, similarly, is not just one person at one place, but a whole collection of collaborating agents. Alice and Bob are not collaborating, but they, except within the parameters of the task. So Bob will make some secret quantum state chosen in a particular Hilbert space. So Alice knows she's going to get, say, a string of polarized photons, but she doesn't know what the quantum state is. He'll give it to her at some point in space-time. And at some later point, he'll say, OK, I want my state back. Give me my state back, please. And she's supposed to give it back to him. And so here we are. He summons it. He asks for it back. He knows what the state is. So he can verify at least with at least probabilistically, he can carry out the projective measurement on p psi to check whether the state was returned. And the question is there some protocol that Alice can carry out for the given summoning task that guarantees that she will indeed return the state that Bob gave her? It's not hard to see that in general, and this is the so-called no-summoning theorem, although it hardly deserves to be a theorem. But it's not hard to see that in general, this is not possible. If the request could come in at either one of two space-like separated points, say Q0 or Q1, well, for Alice to have a protocol that guarantees to be able to respond and give the state, if the request comes at Q0, she must be able to actually produce the state at Q0. But then the no-signaling principle means that whether or not a request came in at Q1 as well as at Q0, she must be able to do that. So the rules are Bob's only supposed to ask for it either at Q0 or Q1. But we can still consider counterfactually what happened if he asked at both. Her protocol must still work in that case, so it must be able to produce psi even if he requested it both. But by symmetry, she must also be able to produce psi if he requested it both at Q1. And so she must be able to make two copies of psi, and that violates no cloning. So without restrictions, we have a no-summoning theorem. In general, it's an impossible task for Alice. And then things become even more interesting when you start imposing restrictions, constraints on the task. So there was a particularly interesting version introduced a while ago by Patrick Hayden and by Alex, who tried to make more precise the idea that we could use this to understand how quantum information, how or where and when quantum information can be in space-time. And the idea of Hayden-May summoning is that you have a set of call points, so I've called them Ys here, Y1, Y2, Y3, where the state could be requested by Bob. And each of them has a corresponding return point. I've called them Zs, so Z1 corresponds to Y1, Z2 to Y2, and so on. Again, remember these are agencies, so in particular, Alice can have an agent at the spatial location of Y1, Y2, and Z1, Z2, and so on. And they know in advance, both parties know in advance, the list of all these points. And the rules of the game here are that Bob will request it at one and only one point, and Alice completes the task if she produces the state at the corresponding return point. So, for instance, if Bob asks for it at Y3, Alice needs to return it at Z3. And there's a very beautiful necessary and sufficient condition theorem saying when summoning is possible and when it's impossible. It's possible if and only if, well, first every reveal point is in the future light cone of the starting point. So way back way back here off the bottom of the diagram, the state was handed over. Alice had better be able to have the state in the causal past of where she needs to return it. So that's, it's kind of obvious that's necessary. And secondly, so we're going to define these things causal diamonds, which are the intersection of the past of the return point with the future of the call point. Secondly, each pair of causal diamonds is causally related, meaning that there's a, in at least one direction, there's a way of getting information from one to the other. There's a causal curve going, let's say, from this one to the other one that we're asking about. So a little thought persuades you that not only is this obviously necessary, but this is obviously necessary. It's the other way around, that's not at all obvious. These are really surprisingly weak conditions. And in particular, if you haven't seen this before, you'll need to think about it. But in particular, you can satisfy them even though there's no causal path running from the start point through all the diamonds. So it's not telling you, sure, you can do it as long as you can send the state on some particular path and here's how to construct the path. It's telling you, you have to split the quantum state up through secret sharing and teleportation and recombine it. But you'll always be able to do that as long as these two weak-looking conditions hold. You can think of variations of this task. So an obvious one is that instead of a single call, you allow multiple calls. So that's unfair on Alice if she has to produce multiple copies of the state. She can't do that. But you can make life easy for her by saying, well, if you get many calls, you only have to return it to one of the possible call points. And that seems strictly easier than the previous task. But in fact, it turns out to be strictly harder. So you need not only the previous conditions, but a total causal ordering of the causal diamonds. This is joint work with Emily here. And again, that's still not telling you there is a causal path through the diamonds. So I have, for instance, this example on the right, you can satisfy multi-call summoning, but the diamonds here are, well, they're degenerate diamonds. They're these black lines, they've collapsed to. No, that can't be right. Think about it. I don't want to get high off on that. You can find simple examples in which there's no causal path through all three causal diamonds, but nonetheless you can satisfy multi-call summoning. On the other hand, this example, which is from Alex and Patrick, is a case where you could satisfy the summoning task if there's a single call, but you can't if there could be more than one call. And then it's natural to sort of extend this further. What are we really doing? Well, you've got a quantum state and you've got to get it somewhere. So where you can get it could depend on information that could be classical or quantum that comes in at lots of points in space-time. You could think about either constrained or unconstrained versions, but the simpler version is the unconstrained one. So let's suppose these are numbers and they're in some given range. Alice knows she'll get a number from 1 to n1 here, and from 1 to n2 here, and so on. But there's no other constraint. There's nothing that says m1 plus m2 plus dot dot mm equals something, for instance. So Alice knows that there's a space-time point determined as a function of the MI that's in some finite list of possible return points. But she doesn't know these MI until they arrive at these points. And so she doesn't know which space-time point she's supposed to return it to until she's got this information. So the idea here is, here's the list of possible return points. One of them is identified by these numbers. Alice has got to get the state, which she, again, was given sometime way back in the past, to the right point. So this, unlike the previous tasks, this makes sense. It's still an interesting task if you think of a classical version of it. The classical version runs like this. Alice is given a classical state at the start point. She's allowed to copy it, she's allowed to broadcast copies of it. But to satisfy the task, she has to return it at one and only one of the return points. And that's why it's non-trivial. I mean, she has the classical information. She could return it everywhere, but she needs some sort of coordination. She needs to know, I'm going to return it. If I return it here, I mustn't return it here or here or here. And it turns out, in fact, that for this particular type of summoning, classical possibility and quantum possibility are equivalent. So you can run arguments along, somewhat along the lines of those for the previous results to establish this equivalence. Okay, so I think I still have a bit of time to talk about the last application. One natural way of thinking of one natural application of this sort of unconstrained summoning is if you're thinking of spending money on a global financial network and the relativistic signaling constraints are important, and you're gathering data around the network, data's coming in all the time, and you have a trading algorithm that says you want to spend your money at some particular point on the network, which depends on the incoming data. So to step back a bit, what features do we want from whatever sort of money is going to be used here? Well, we want summonability. We want it to be able to satisfy these summoning tasks. We would really like, we're assuming time is critical here, so we'd really like instant verifiability. We'd like the issuer, whoever gave the money, to be able to validate it just locally without having to cross-check around the network. That's in tension with the other thing that we would like, which is preventing double spending. So the issuer should have a guarantee that if it's presented here, it can't have been presented here or here or here, even though they're space-like separated, so they haven't got time to cross-check. And we'd probably like user privacy, at least in the restricted form, that the issuer shouldn't know in advance where the user is going to spend the money. Once it's spent, okay. So my thought, I'd like to persuade you, is that once you start thinking about tasks where money-related tasks where causal relations are important, you need to reconceptualize money. The thought is to reframe money as any combination, any of hardware and software that guarantees those four properties. And notice, just as summoning tasks can't generally be solved by sending a quantum state on a definite path, this means that the money we define like this, which is supposed to be summonable, isn't going to be generally associated with any definite paths through space-time. So it's not going to be a physical object like a banknote, even if you could move a banknote at light speed. And notice that these first three conditions either don't make sense at all or they're very trivial to ensure if we're not worrying about relativity. So this is really an intrinsically relativistic discussion. Also, I don't want to overclaim. I'm not saying this is the one and only one natural way of thinking about money in space-time. There are other desirable properties. They may be relevant. They may be absolutely critical in other contexts. I just want to argue that this is a useful definition, not that it's the only possible definition. Okay, well, great news. We've known since the start of quantum cryptography that there's a solution to this in the form of Wiesner's quantum money. So if we picture Wiesner's quantum money as a banknote with a serial number, the serial number can be sent everywhere. The quantum state the user doesn't know, so the quantum state the user can only propagate as an unknown quantum state, but that's enough to allow it to respond to any possible quantum summoning task. It's instantly verifiable as long as the bank's agents know the information about the quantum states as well as the corresponding serial numbers. No double spending, basically because you can't duplicate the quantum state. So that's guaranteed by, it takes more than no cloning, but there is a full security proof, the unforgeability of quantum money. User privacy, well, as long as the user's classical and quantum comms are secure, the issuer can't tell what they're doing until they present the money. That's great news. the only slight issue, and there's a bit of a parallel here with QPV schemes, is we have a theoretically great solution with a practical problem, and the practical problem here is you need long-term quantum state storage, and we don't have that at present. Even if we do have it, it seems likely that it's going to be expensive and difficult for a long, long time. So that motivates looking for alternatives. Here is an alternative, which I'm just going to summarize very briefly. And if anybody's interested, I can take you through it in much more detail. So-called S-money. So these are schemes that are defined by pre-agreed rules. The rules ensure that the user commits to only one valid presentation point, but keeps it private from the issuer. The schemes give privacy through short-range quantum communications when the token is first set up, but it doesn't need long-range quantum communications, and it doesn't need quantum memory. And privacy is guaranteed by things that are almost bit commitment protocols, that asterisk there that I'll come to in a minute. And they are practical with current technology. All they need is short-range QKD and fast classical communication and computation. Challenging, but practical. So maybe I'll skip over this. But it can, because of the previous results, it can solve every summoning task that's solved by quantum money. So it also has all the desiderata that I set out, those four. Doesn't need a long-term quantum memory. And here's the asterisk. These are not unconditionally secure relativistic quantum bit commitments, but they don't need to be. They're for something that's slightly weaker that we call relativistic bit coordination. Here is the first proof of principle test, and we're hoping for a fuller implementation to be demonstrated in the next few months. So why am I mentioning this here? Because it gives a motivation for a whole set of non-local computation tasks where we'd really like to understand what the resource efficiency. The task could be something like this, that you, some given time, you're getting price or other information all around the world, and you want to spend your money at the place where the price, let's say, is, spend the money at, as soon as possible, at the place where the price here was minimized, to take a simple illustration. You could do that with S-money or quantum money, in principle. It takes the time for a light signal to travel between antipodal points. And if you think about it, with ordinary classical money, you take twice as long. So both of them give a significant advantage over that. As far as we know, the best quantum algorithm involves a horrible collection of non-local telecomputations that successively go through every point on your network and require huge quantum resources. But that's as far as we know. What's the most efficient algorithm? Are there much more efficient ways to do this or to achieve some tasks analogous to this? That's a completely open question, I think, and one which the techniques and results that are going to be discussed later in the meeting should have considerable bearing on. So I'm just going to flash up the things. We're hoping to learn from our friends and colleagues in the ADS-CFT community what ADS-CFT tells us about the likely efficiency of these non-local computations. And that's the topic of talks tomorrow and later in the week. And I'd just like to close with a summary of a few key points. If we're worrying about practical QPV, and we clearly are, we need security models that one way or another address these detachment and dislocation replacement attacks. One natural model, given that we have to make physical assumptions anyway, is to allow the tags to be cryptographically secure. I'm not claiming it's the only natural model, but it should certainly be there on the table in in discussions. This prevents the replacement attacks, and it also allows the QPV protocols to be purely classical. In that model, and I suspect in all models, practical QPV with good precision is very challenging, but it looks as though it should be possible. We know that these beautiful simulation results by Harry and Kvir and friends imply that QPV without cryptographically secure tags is theoretically very cool. What we don't know is whether we don't know how much entanglement is actually needed, so we don't know whether they're likely to be technologically secure. And many of the later talks are going to touch on this. And there is a much I tried to persuade you in the last part of the talk, there's a much broader set of questions that also results in this area ought to illuminate. So a great deal to learn, and I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the talks. Thanks, everybody.
Questions for Harry? Sorry.
Harry, please.
So yeah, thanks a lot for the talk. It was great. We're called here QPV, but for me, QPV can also be like a building block for things like position-based authentication of messages, where you know a message comes from somewhere, or encryption, where you know a message can only be read at some location. How do you think that your objections to the standard security model transfer to those tasks?
That's a great question. Objections, these are comments on different security models. As I say, all the models should be on the table. I haven't thought about, it's an obvious question, and I'm aware I should think about it in detail, but I haven't thought about it in detail. Maybe during the meeting we can make a lot of progress on that. They certainly still need to be discussed. The question is can they be much more easily countered? Can they be countered by software rather than hardware?
And I had one very small question. It's a purely classical QPV protocols, but why do we still have the Q there? I guess.
Yeah. Well, so the thought is you're still using QKD in order to replenish the key, and that's why you have the Q. But what's purely classical, so maybe I've compressed this too much, is the query response exchanges in the actual protocol.
I see. Yes, this is just a comment, but I think in the classical world, also sometimes these PUFs, physically clonable functions, are studied. And I guess those would also be suitable for classical position verification in a provable hardware model. Mm-hmm. Very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
So in that stage there with the refreshing the key with the QKD, are there any other security conditions that we need to take into account there? Or is it just purely just doing QKD just to replenish key? Is there any other subtleties there when you combine these?
Not that I'm aware of. We're all here to learn. So if anybody has a thought of something that might have been overlooked, I'd love to hear it. But not that I'm aware of.
There's a question back here. So I guess this is sort of a follow up on your security model point. So it seems to me that more or less you're arguing that not only do we need to verify the location, but we need to authenticate the person. And then you've used QKD to do this, but then your key consumption is very high. I guess my question is this a fair way of reducing your argument to just we need authentication and QPV? Because then I would sort of expect, given the fact you can authenticate a channel with very little key, there should be ways to save on the key by not doing full-blown QKD each round. Does that make sense?
Well, sentence by sentence it makes sense. I'm just not sure. I'm not sure I'm persuaded. And again, here to learn, so maybe you could persuade me. I'm not sure I'm persuaded that you can securely keep on verifying the position just with infrequent resource light authentication. I mean,
yeah. Okay. I mean, that was my question.
Yeah.
Because, like, technically, I, at least when I look at it, it's like, okay, you really want two security conditions now being run in parallel. Like, I want to authenticate somehow, and I want to verify the position. And your point is, normally QPV doesn't do both. Here's a way to do both.
Yeah.
But then the question is, like, do you really need all those resources to do both? Since we know if I just did authentication, I could use very little key to do that.
Yeah. I mean, we did, maybe this is helpful. We did think about the thought that, you know, Alice could send a message to Bob saying what time is it and where are you? And Bob could send a message back authenticated with, as you say, little key. But it didn't seem that that was any more secure than, the security, level of security was just the number of bits used in the authentication. And it seemed like you might as well just send the string itself rather than use it to authenticate a longer message. But maybe there's something subtler and cleverer that could save resources.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I was a little bit worried about this replenishing the key.
Yeah.
What if it somehow is sort of gone, I mean, by some man in the middle attack, or sort of it's spoofed too often and sort of the key is not there anymore?
Yeah, I don't think any QPV system can prevent what's effectively jamming.
No, but the other one, the one that doesn't use a key, the one that you started out with,
still can't prevent jamming, right? I mean,
sure, but then once the jamming is over, you can sort of start again.
Right. I suppose my thought is if again, it depends on your scenario. My sort of working assumption is if somebody has been messing with your tag enough to break your protocol, you better do something more than just say, oh, well, something went wrong for a while and let's restart the protocol. You better actually investigate what's happening. Otherwise you're incredibly vulnerable. Suppose they jam for a second. Well, now you're incredibly vulnerable to move and replacement attacks. You're giving them the jamming interval in order to do whatever they want physically with the tagged system. But in a different, maybe there are scenarios in which it doesn't matter so much. I struggle to think of one off the top of my head, but I'm sure we could find one. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, maybe we should talk a little bit more about this.
Okay.
One last question. I thought one of the motivations to do QPV at all was sort of like if you want to run a QKD protocol, then you need like an authenticated channel, and like then you can use QPV to run it, to do the authentication. But if you already need a key to sort of do the QPV part, I mean, then does it sort of imply that QKD is actually not possible in the sense that you can generate a secret key, you can only expand it, like sort of if you start with a small secret key, then you can sort of like make it longer.
Does this tie in with Florian's question earlier? I mean,
There was a similar question.
I'm not sure. Yeah. I mean, my understanding of QKD is indeed that it really should be called QKE. You need a secret key to start in, and then you can run quantum key expansion. And that's the standard use case and use mode for QKD. And that's what we're using here for sure. There are lots of motivations for verifying the position of something, but one of them is you want to verify the position of something, not that you want to. You don't necessarily want to do anything else.
That's one of the motivations I like.
Yeah. So we have to go case by case through those motivations and see which models are sensible, I think.
Okay. Thank you for reading it.
Thank you.